This podcast was recorded and produced in the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations. We pay respects to elders past and present. Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land. We acknowledge the First Nations people who fought and continue to fight police violence and colonial violence. This podcast is only possible because of the continued resistance and leadership of Aboriginal communities. This episode contains descriptions of police violence and racial profiling. Please take care while listening.
I'll say there's one example. It was, this was around COVID. This was when the COVID had the curfew, and we were not even over curfew. I think we were like maybe 5 minutes over curfew, sitting in a park. All of us got Maccas, you know, we're sitting down eating. Next thing we know, two cars show up, flashing lights on, and they're charging full speed, just running at us. And, you know, at that time we were young, we were still 14, you know, we were very young. So I think half the kids ran because they got scared. They're just like, nah. Some of the kids have experienced that before and just like, nah, I don't want to experience it again. And this one kid, he didn't experience this yet. So he stood still thinking that was the right thing to do. And even just standing still, he got tackled straight away. And he had three officers on him all over just because of the curfew time. Basically just jumping on top of you and just falling on top of you, and then you'd have more officers doing that. And I was probably the oldest one there, so the kid was 13 or 12 at the time.
This is The People's Record, and I'm Idil Ali. I'm public housing raised here in Nam, and in this podcast, I want to tell you the inside story of our world, our struggle, and our resistance. I will be speaking with community members, activists, academics, lawyers, and allies about the realities of our lives in public housing and what it means to be policed in our own home. Over 5 episodes, you're going to hear a pattern, a story of our containment, an attempt at erasing us, and how we refuse to disappear. This is episode 1. What name am I using for you, actually?
Yeah, what do you want to use?
What do you want to use?
Whatever. Whatever's easy for you to remember. Because you're going to be, you know, applying to things. I'm not going to be saying my own name.
Yeah. No, but I feel like you should choose your own alias.
Ahmed.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah? Alright, Ahmed.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
No, you don't like it. Choose something else.
Yeah, I can be Ahmed. I'm Ahmed.
Ahmed from Carlton chose a pseudonym, and Musab from Richmond did the same. Because when you grow up black in public housing in Melbourne, your name is data, your face is data, your family, your friends, your interests are all data. And that data gets collected, stored, and used, and not in your best interest. So even something as simple as doing an interview, you have to calculate the risk.
When you grow up and you're so traumatized and you know so much things about these people, they really are, like, I can tell you, like, a police officer, when he's not even a police, like, he's off duty just by the way he walks, because the way he's used to holding his belt and certain gestures that he does with his shoulder, certain things, I can just tell you, hey, this guy, but I shouldn't know these things. Do you know what I mean? And it's trauma, yeah. You know?
I'm probably going to start us off with a question. Name. What do you want me to use?
Musab.
Musab.
Musab Khamis.
Can I say it? How do you want me to say it? Musab?
Yeah.
Okay.
Marhab, my name is Musab. Musab Khamis.
How old were you when you were having your first experiences of policing?
13. On a tram. We were coming back from the city. Mm. And we all hopped out the tram. I think we had a lot of us there. It was maybe like 15. Mm-hmm. 15 of us. We just came back from like, I think it was called a GAD.
A what?
A GAD.
A GAD.
I don't know what it's called. A GAD, like a little party.
Oh, a gathering.
Like, yeah.
Get out. A GAD.
They say GAD for short. Okay. Like, it's weird. But
back in my day, we said house. But okay.
No, but we all hopped at the tram, and two cop cars came in front of the tram. And at that time, we were still young. We didn't understand that, like,
what's about to happen.
Yeah. So I remember one of our mates waved at them. Kid you not, waved at them. And the next thing they did, you just saw 4 doors open, so two doors from each car, and cops screaming at us saying, get on the ground. And at that point, like, they're just aiming stuff at us. So we're just like, whoa. So...
What stuff?
To be honest, I couldn't tell you to what I'm not going to say it was, but
yeah,
what it looked like to me, it looked like a gun.
Mm-hmm.
So half of us rose up and the other half ran because it was just like, and our heads, we were thinking we're about to get shot for no reason. So we ran, and the next thing I remember was two kids almost got hit by a car, by a police vehicle. So the police vehicle drove onto the pedestrian way and tried hitting the kids. The kids got past and they got tackled straight away by officers around the corner.
Mm.
All the roads were blocked off by the vans, and they were just full on chasing us, just tackling everyone.
Mm.
And when they rounded us up, they accused us of a crime that happened.
All 15 of you?
All 15 of us. They said we were the suspects, and we literally told them we had nothing to do with it. And my thoughts were, at the time, that was when we were getting onto social media. So we started seeing what was happening in America.
Mm-hmm.
So our immediate thought was just, because of our skin color, that's what we're going through. Because it was crazy that was happening to us. It got worse. Now there wasn't just targeting of what your color was, but of your status, where you lived. And it became a thing where they thought that if you lived in the flats or lived in public housing, that you were just a thug or a criminal. And sooner than later, everyone started copying the same thing. Everyone started going through the exact same thing. Yeah, to be honest, it confuses me a lot. It really confuses me a lot because I'll say for years, we just copped it straight. It's just to the point that if we saw them, we just knew to walk away or try and get away. But even then, you'd have a car in front of your face with the flashing lights, and next thing you know, you're getting searched for no reason without a probable cause. Just brings it back, like we never understood that wasn't right, you know. We just thought that was just a daily thing that we had to go to, and I feel like we got so used to it, to the point where we knew the procedure. Like we got stopped and we knew what we had to do. We knew, oh yeah, we have to stand legs apart, stretch your arms out, wait to get searched, let them go through your bag. And it's just, I don't know, for years we just went through it, and I never, like, realizing when I grew up that wasn't right. I don't want my siblings to go through it. I don't want, like, my little cousins to go through the same thing we went through.
Mm.
It wasn't fair on us. I feel like it really shaped a lot of people.
Yeah.
It really changed a lot of people, you know.
The story that Musab shares is the same as so many. The procedure, the rite of passage, the coming of age of boys into men in the flats, an initiation into black adulthood in Australia. To be able to speak about policing, we need to first speak about who we are as the people being policed. Most of our parents came here as young couples seeking a home and safety for their futures. We're the first generation to have our youth here.
Thank you so much, Ahmed, for coming in. I wanted to ask, first and foremost, what was it like growing up in Carlton?
Carlton has had its times. Growing up, it was really good. Like, it was really community-based. It was really community-orientated. It was a really nice place to grow up, I reckon.
What made it nice? Like, what made you feel like it was community-oriented?
A lot of things. The camps we went to together and, like, the different primary schools that we had all in the region, the different ethnicities, they were all like neighbours and things like that.
Reem grew up in Flemington and North Melbourne, just a few kilometres from Ahmed.
I grew up in both North Melbourne and Flemington. So it was like having a massive family and just being around a big family. Like everyone knew each other and everyone knew what was happening to each other. So if any big thing happened or any like both positive and negative thing was happening, we were like so in each other's lives. You know, like you have those big Italian families you see on TV. It was like that, but like bigger. But also it was like we're all from different countries, predominantly East African, Horn of Africans, so like Somali, Eritrean, Ethiopian and so forth. But there was like Vietnamese and people from Timor and like and many other, like El Salvadorian as well. So it was like living there was like feeling, I felt safe because I felt it wasn't just my family looking over me. It's like the community looking over me. And I felt I had a really, like, good childhood because of it, you know?
This is Daniel.
Flemington was home. So basically grew up in Housing Commission estates, so about 20 stories high. We had, all the public open space, the parks downstairs were sort of like our backyard. So it felt like a very tight-knit sort of community because we all sort of, were first-generation African-Australians. We moved there and we're still finding our feet. So it was a very interesting, sometimes confusing, sometimes very adventurous kind of upbringing.
20-story towers, or 12, high-rise public housing in the inner city, the park downstairs, that was our backyard, and the place where everything happened. And from the windows above, the aunties could see everything, and they were definitely keeping note. I feel like one of my favourite memories growing up in Carlton, do you remember before the buildings had, like, any locks and stuff? Like, before the buildings had any passes to get in?
Yeah, yeah.
And, like, I just remember 510, like, the 44 home tree. And I remember one time all of your age group, like you guys, you're a few years older than me, right? Like,
yeah.
I just remember one time all the older kids were there. We were there. The younger kids were there. And we were like, you know, last one to the 44 home tree. And everyone knows what the 44 home tree. We're all running to it, yeah. All of that. And then after we played a few rounds, the older kids were like, okay, we're going to play cops and robbers. And like, I think what I loved about it was like, even though we were younger, we were still allowed to play with you guys. So yeah. Then you guys, and then even the way you guys split the teams, like it's all fair. Like, you know, the captains are the same age and they're just choosing from different age groups. And
that's how it was in Carlton. It was like, that was the thing with everything in sport as well. Like we used to create our own games.
Yeah, knockout.
Like you said, like the 44 home tree, like you see, like that tree is just like, we all knew what it was. You know, that was the tree. You come out, first one to that tree, last 15, only 15 people can play. If it's too many for certain things, otherwise the game's never going to end.
Yeah.
And it was like certain rules that everyone knew how to, like, you know,
go
by and things like that.
The 44 home tree. If you didn't grow up in Carlton, that means nothing to you. But if you did, you know exactly what tree I'm talking about. Life in the flats had its own rhythm. The times of the year when the whole community came alive in specific ways. Personally, my favourite part of growing up was like summer nights, everybody comes downstairs, all the moms have pictures of like, you know, cordial and things, and like it was such a community space, and like your parents didn't have to be down because some parents were down, so you were all able to, like all the kids were able to go downstairs. And I think that at the same time, although summer was my favourite time, we knew that things would happen every single summer. I want to ask you about Ramadan soccer.
Ramadan soccer. So Ramadan soccer used to kind of be like, it's like the World Cup. Like that's what it was, like for real. It's like the World Cup that comes around every year for a month, you know. That month, the best players in Victoria, sometimes even other states, come if they can get into a team that is as well. It's really hard back in the days as well. It's prestige. It was elite. It starts around 10 o'clock and it goes until about 2:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And to be honest with you, it works absolutely perfect.
Yeah, because people finish praying Tarawih. Finish Tarawih,
eating, everything's settled, you know, you've had your chats, your parents, everything's just...
This is what the flats gave us. Not just housing, a village. Something that's reminiscent of what our parents had back home.
And I remember, like, I never had to kind of worry about my laundry. It's like, this is other family will take it out, put it inside for you.
Sometimes they fold it for you.
They fold it for you. Somebody's there, there's bored. You know, one of the aunties, they'll fold it up for you while it's warm, you know.
Yeah.
It's a lovely thing. It's a lovely place, you know. And you understand, once in a while, someone's desperate.
They need a new outfit.
I want to grab a jacket, you know.
And you see them wearing it.
Yeah,
and
it's crazy.
You can't say nothing.
Yeah, you see sometimes a junkie wearing your school uniform and he's telling you that, you know, hey, I got this last week. I bought it from Nike. And it's your school uniform. You're like, relax, man, you know. It didn't matter who you were, what color you were. You've had a connection with everyone. Everyone had a connection with everyone.
We built all of this ourselves. Not the towers. The state built those. But everything inside them. The rules of the games, the rhythm of the estates, the way the aunties watched from above, that was ours. This was home. This was the village. This felt safe. Until it didn't.
But I remember when I was a kid, I believed that Flemington had a curfew. Like, for the longest time, I thought that that was something that just existed. And I would talk to people from other, I'd be like, oh, we don't want to be in Flemington because Flemington has to, like, you know, they have that curfew. Like, young people are not meant to be out after a certain time. And I genuinely thought it was like a bylaw thing in my child mind. And it wasn't until years later that it was like, oh no, it's kind of a community, like parents tell their kids to go home, the teenagers to go home because they're concerned. The teenagers know if they're out that something's going to happen to them.
I think because we'd make up like worlds downstairs, like we'd make up our own worlds, right? You'd imagine new things and create worlds for yourself. And so I think I hit a certain age where those worlds started like becoming much more of a reality. Like not those worlds exactly, like I think the glass shattered and I realized that it wasn't all what I thought it was in my head, you know? So things started happening and things I started noticing and I was like, oh, this is not as safe as I thought it would be.
So why does this happen? Why Flemington? Why North Melbourne? Why Carlton? Why young black boys in public housing? To understand that, you have to understand how policing changed and when. For people who grew up in the flats in the 90s, it looked one way. For people who grew up after 9/11, it looked very different. Ilo was born in Chile and grew up in the Fitzroy Flats during the 90s.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because like, I think my growing up in the flats is different. I had a different reality because it was pre 9/11, right? It was before. There was surveillance and there was a police presence, but it was a, like I said, it was like a shadow, right? It wasn't as overt. The Fitzroy police station in that time, I don't know why, but it was always in my head and amongst our group of friends. It was like, they're all corrupt. You know, like that was the zeitgeist at that time.
Yeah.
And so they never showed up. You know, they were never like, it wasn't that police were like coming to our barbecues. We never had police come to our school. We never had police camps.
Yeah.
The closest we had was the blue light disco.
Yeah.
Right? That was the closest thing we had. But everything else, it was just that they were a character that would come in and enforce the law on you if you broke it. It was more like the boogeyman. You know, like it was the thing that if you stuffed up, then police will come and get you and they will get you. And so there was never this pretension, which I think has changed now. There was never this idea that, oh, police are going to come and be friendly with you and hang out. What's your name? Like, at least with our group of friends, that was never, we never had that. It was much more like a stick rather than the carrot.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Whereas I think after 9/11 and when the surveillance state just grew to what it is now, they've realized like, oh, it's better to have them close because then we can get their names and we can know who they are and identify them easier.
Yeah.
Which is like more perverse, I think. It's like more perverse because...
Definitely a poisonous carrot.
Oh, 100%.
The poisonous carrot. The shift from beating you on the street to befriending you at the barbecue. Both are forms of control. One is just harder to see. So the method changed. But why us? Why these flats and why these kids? This is Crystal McKinnon, a Yamatji woman, an academic and activist.
Obviously, racism and colonialism goes hand in hand because who do you know? How do you know who you can colonize, you know? Racialization is the process through which we learn how to treat different communities through the larger world, I guess. So through media and government, public discourse and various other things, the process of racialization is central to creating different groups of people, which is how the kind of liberal settler colonial states maintain power. And these processes of racialization are embedded within all of the kind of various state and government institutions and teaching institutions, all institutions, you know, and it shifts as well, like what we're taught to think about certain communities shifts with government agendas, right?
Ilo's generation got the boogeyman, the police who showed up when you broke the rules. Our generation got something different. After 9/11, the rules changed. Young, black, Muslim public housing, that combination became a target, not because of anything we did, because what the state decided we met. They wanted to know who you were, who your cousins were, and what you were talking about in the park. They wanted intelligence. And the flats, with their single entries and their shared backyards, became the perfect lab for a new kind of surveillance. And in Flemington, in North Melbourne, in Carlton, where lots of young black Muslim men lived in public housing, that became a siege. Sharon Dev is a longtime street-trained paralegal and explains what he's seen over the years.
You know, like post Daniel Hay-Markle's case, I think the forms of racial profiling have become much more institutionalised and much more pervasive much more widespread and, as I said, intensified. You know, out west side now, we've got detectives posted to individual young black folk. And when I mean young, I'm talking about 10, 11. You know, not these aren't stops in the street or searches or vehicle stops. This is the most profound system of surveillance and policing and priming for the prison industrial complex.
Remember the aunties at the windows? They watch the kids to keep them safe. Now the state watches them too, but not to protect them.
I think we underestimate the violence of being afraid, like the fear. It's like colonialism and, you know, in the kind of frontier days and, you know, beyond in that, it's, you know, violence everywhere and the way that racist capital colonial systems maintain power. They inflict violence, you know, sporadically and without cause, and then that creates an atmosphere of fear within communities. And so then people act in a certain way, you know, and that's also, I think, what they do. Like they, you know, and the fear that you are going to be harmed, like if you leave your house or if you look the wrong way at somebody or whatever, it's a really violent way to live.
I feel like when they realised that we knew our rights, they'd try and find a loophole, try and find any way to just get us, you know? Whether them saying, oh, you were going too slow, or you were speeding, or when you're going the speed limit, you know, just trying to find any way to just stop you, just so they could try and find a reason to get you, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes I feel like young people tell me stories of, like, it's like they just want to keep you talking so that you might say something that they can follow that line of conversation, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
In 2010, a decade before Musab's COVID story, around the time many of the voices on this podcast were growing up in the flats, a group of young men from Flemington did something unprecedented. They took Victoria Police to court. They sued them for racial profiling, and it changed everything. On paper, at least.
When you have a look at the data and the complaints, they're happening throughout, like for years.
Yeah.
So it was a intense period, but it wasn't totally unrepresentative of what was going on over a long period.
Yeah.
In the case itself, we were able to obtain an operation that the police were running in 2006 called Operation Molto.
Yeah,
so we were able to get it from through the whole subpoenaing process. And it showed really clearly that they were targeting young African males at the North Melbourne and Flemington housing estates.
Mm-hmm.
That's what was clearly, they were the subject of the target of the operation. So that's what was going on.
Tamar Hopkins was the lawyer who took the case. And when she talks about that time, you can hear how big it felt.
There was so much interest. The media was interested, constantly coming to us for information about what's going on. We had students wanting to come and assist. We had young people from the community wanting to come and assist. We had this incredible group called Amara that started and was working with community and us to talk about issues of racial profiling. And so it was just all like the collecting around that centre. This was clearly, the Flemington Legal Centre was clearly, you know, this was it. And we were having complaints coming from all around Victoria as well. People were asking for assistance. And so we just decided, okay, let's call this the Police Accountability Project and let's really put, you know, all of our resources into trying to, you know, build up the expertise and the community support at this centre for this project.
They built a case. They gathered evidence. They got the data that proved what everyone already knew. The police were targeting young black men, systematically, by design, and the community had had enough.
Challenging such a powerful entity is just impossible. So for us, we didn't actually think that we would be able to gain any sort of justice. But we said, hey, let's look at the big picture. Like, you know, we're newcomers in this country, and we've all had this collective experience, and we've been treated this way, and we know it's not right. Our parents don't think this is such a big deal because they've seen worse. But for us, we kind of see a future here. So how do we ensure that this doesn't happen? Or how do we minimize this happening to future generations? Because as newcomers, we don't expect the law or people's behaviors to change towards us in a very short time. That means that we get justice. But if we don't get justice, then how do we make it better for our kids or our peers or the younger generation coming through so that we have a positive impact?
Next time on The People's Record, what happened when the community took the police to court, what we won, what we lost, and what we learned about the limits of the law. This is The People's Record, and I'm Idil Ali.
This podcast was produced by Ila Diaz and Lucy Griffin for the Center Against Racial Profiling. Hosted by Idil Ali, edited and mixed by Andrew Hutan and McEwen. Music by Pip Norman and designed by Peter Morgan. The People's Records thanks the Community Broadcast Fund, 3CR, and Humdinger Studios for their generous support.